since we've reopened, there is a lot more staycations. We've had a lot more Irish people who have actually come to the restaurant for the first time. I hope that with the pandemic, one of the positives is that people might re-experience their own place and actually enjoy the food offering from that place.
Today on Dirty Linen, we are heading across the seas to Ireland, to Galway, a place that I love a lot. My father-in-law is from Galway. We are talking to chef and restaurateur JP McMahon. He's the owner of the Michelin-starred Anya, Spanish Cava Bodega, and wine bar Tartare. He's also the founder of the food symposium Food on the Edge, which is happening this October, both virtual and in person. You've been to Australia, and I know that there are Australians taking part in Food on the Edge. I saw that you've just announced Mark Best, JP. But firstly, welcome to Dirty Linen. I'm really thrilled to be chatting to you.
Thanks so much.
It's really great to have you on the show. You're such a huge figure in the food scene in the UK, and I'm really keen to hear from you. First of all, just what's the situation like? You've reopened. How are things?
Yeah, they're kind of fair to middling, I suppose. We reopened just 2.5 weeks ago, and an ear had been closed for 18 months. Cava had been closed pretty much maybe half of that time, and Tartare we had kept open as a takeaway throughout. It was up and down, I'm sure, as it was everywhere in the world. I mean, some good and some bad came of it. Like we I suppose pivoted to doing all of our cooking classes online. And they were quite successful. So at least they kept us busy. We did some kids cooking classes with about 200 kids. So, I mean, that was good. I suppose the bad side is we still don't know what the effects are, in the sense of, even for example with the near, it's quite dependent on tourism. We at the moment we have like a lot of Irish people on a staycation, like, so they're staying at home, but it'll be interesting to see how the dynamic changes after say September, when the schools start again. And so it's still, we're kind of going through I suppose unknown territory.
I mean, we watched from Australia with great interest when there was, you know, the much vaunted Freedom Day in the UK, and very much dependent on the high rate of vaccination. I mean, there are thousands of cases a day in Ireland at the moment, but a reasonably high vaccination rate. I just checked before, it's something like 65% of the adult population is fully vaccinated. What's the feeling like? You know, are you still wearing masks? Are people feeling confident? You know, what's it like?
Yeah, like it's somewhere in the middle. It's kind of like they say we're coming towards the end, but I suppose we've been at the end a few times, and like in contrast to say Copenhagen, where I have friends working and cooking, and there's like no masks anymore, and they have a very large antigen, free antigen program with, as well as the vaccination. And if for some reason that's it's something that Ireland rejected. So you have to be vaccinated to eat indoors. Like, you can't get a negative PCR test or have an antigen test. Now, they say they're going to do away with that next month, but the cases are 2,000 a day approximately, and some of the people are getting reinfected, and some of the people are still not vaccinated, and then there's a lot of people I know who don't want to get vaccinated. So it's a hard one to call.
What's the mechanism by which you ensure that people are vaccinated if they want to dine inside?
There is a certificate, like, and it's an EU-wide cert. So you get vaccinated and you get your certificate. I have mine, and you have to show it if you want to eat inside. I think they're going to introduce it in both France and New York now. And I don't know if it's working, in the sense of like the cases are going up anyway, so it's very hard. We have the Delta variant over here, so which is supposed to be more contagious. So yeah, it's a hard one to call, as in like the live entertainment and the theater and the arts industry is still closed, and they're asking to open. It was like sport is open, but ironically the theaters and the music festivals have all been cancelled. So they're still a lot closed.
Oh, that's so interesting, because yeah, I had this vision of Freedom Day that everything was just happening, but it's clearly not like that.
No, I suppose even in the UK when they had Freedom Day, like they pulled back on quite a bit of things now, and I suppose they're trying to veer towards personal responsibility as opposed to regulations, and possibly as we approach. In Ireland, I think we have 80% of the population has had one dose, and I think as we approach the 80% with two doses, I think they're going to have to do something. Like I think in Greece now, they have opened everything and just said, well, the vaccinated are vaccinated, the unvaccinated are not, and they can't keep the economy closed any longer, because I suppose at the end of the day, there's only so long you can keep the economy closed, because we're borrowing money, restaurants, we're still getting grants because we have maybe 30% of our seats not used because of social distancing. So there's only so long that we can, I suppose, do that before, I suppose, the society itself becomes under severe pressure.
Yeah, I mean, we're in Australia, you know, Melbourne and Sydney, the two biggest cities, are in lockdown now. Things in Sydney are particularly bad, but, you know, Melbourne's not feeling great either. And we have seen big protests against the lockdowns, especially in Melbourne today. It was, you know, the biggest one, and to my mind, the most alarming one, because you do just get a sense that if people aren't going to stay locked down, if people aren't going to abide by the rules, then it's, there's just really not going to be any getting on top of it. I mean, we're told we've got to live with the virus. We've got Delta here as well, but we've got a very low vaccination rate, just around 25%. So it's frankly pretty scary.
Yeah, and I suppose the scary thing is that you still have a lot of people that think that COVID is just the flu and it's not real. And like I have friends and that think that, and they refuse to get vaccinated, and it does cause, it's almost like a civil war through a virus, because like unfortunately you kind of you don't meet them as often, you don't talk to them as often, because all they ever want to talk about is like what the vaccine is and what COVID is. And I suppose for me it's trying to move on from it, and at the same time I really don't think that Ireland could do another lockdown. I don't think the will of the people is there, but I'm not sure. Like it's like even with the high vaccine rate, the cases are still rising. And but I honestly don't know what the solution is, because if they lock down hospitality again, there's already places have closed, so it will do severe damage to that sector in the economy. And there's also, I mean, the tragedy is that there are other sectors like the pharmaceutical sector, the tech sector, that are actually like making vast quantities of money during this. So not only do you have like lockdown and I suppose the ill effects that come of that, but you do have a division emerging in society where some sectors are absolutely like are just taking it away. I think even if you look at some of the takeaway companies, like the large ones, Domino, or then you look at Amazon, I mean their profits have increased exponentially. And that will continue.
Yeah, I guess there's these different fault lines where divisions can appear and grow wider through this whole period. Yeah, both, I guess, philosophically, if that's what you want to call anti-vax, and also financially. It's really, it is really interesting. Just with the vaccine passport, or people having to show that certificate, I mean, what's that like, you know, at the door of the restaurant? Is that a sort of a fraught time for people? Is it sort of, you know, three people have got it, one person doesn't, and they're told to sit outside? I mean, is that a tricky thing for your staff to negotiate?
No, I thought it would be. And before it came in, everyone was getting excited and we were getting loads of hate mail saying we were contributing towards this division in society and they were going to book the restaurant and not turn up. And there was different champions of saying that people need to oppose it. But in fairness, when it came in, it has been very smooth. I mean, you can present your certificate or you can scan it. We found that it takes a little bit of time at the door, but most people, I suppose, just want to eat out and they want to go in, and it has actually worked quite well. I mean, in Denmark, they started it in April along with antigen testing, and I really think that is the way to go, because it just seems to have worked quite well. But for some reason, the Irish NEFIS, the Irish Health Board, who are looking after this, distrust antigen tests, so we didn't. But like, I'm really surprised. Like, it has been actually quite smooth in spite of the opposition. Now, I'm sure it's a different case in the pubs where it's a bit more casual, but in the restaurants, we just ask people to, if they're booking in, just to make sure that they have their vaccination passes, and 90% of the time they have them, and it runs quite smoothly.
And what about your staff, JP?
They're nearly all vaccinated now. I think there's one or two that are not, and I think one hasn't got vaccinated because she's pregnant, and the other I'm not too sure. But we all have masks on, and I suppose we do what we can in terms of trying to limit the spread of any virus. We've been lucky that we had to close Tartar at Christmas because our manager got COVID. It was only a day or two before they actually shut down the whole country again. But like, I suppose it is scary when one of your staff gets it and then you only have one team and it's a close contact. Everyone's a close contact and you just have to close immediately and tell everyone in the restaurant, I'm really sorry, we have to close. and everyone just leaves. And it's a very surreal experience. And that was back in December. But like since then, yeah, we've been lucky, and any of the staff that, I suppose, even though they're vaccinated, if they feel that they may have it, they can get a test and get a result in 24 hours and they just stay home, and touch wood, no one has, I suppose, been reinfected.
Yeah. Yeah. The rapid antigen testing is a big conversation here as well, particularly in the event world where people are saying, you know, to get sport back up and going, to get theatre back up and going, and concerts as well, you know, why don't they just require people to do a rapid test before they enter? It hasn't been taken up here. I think they're doing a trial in in South Australia to some small degree, but yeah, it hasn't really been taken up here either. Just same as in Ireland. But I know from a friend in London, she said that they can just go to any chemist, get a test for free, one of those rapid tests, and then, you know, head to the pub or whatever it is.
Yeah, no, it's quite amazing. And I had friends go to a big 40,000 music festival in England. They had to do an antigen test. You upload it to the NHS. You get your results within 20 minutes, and then you go in. And for me, it's a no-brainer. I'm not a scientist, but like in terms of what it can achieve and allow, I suppose, us to open more things, particularly now, like we have some weird division in Ireland between sport and theatre, in the sense that the sport has had people back and you have stadiums full of 40,000 people, but you still can't have like a big rock concert. So it's that's, I suppose, where we're at. But look, they're still talking about using antigen tests. I mean, people themselves are actually using them. You can buy them, and people actually, I know groups of people who are meeting up, say if 12 friends are meeting up, they actually are doing it themselves. Like, they're under no obligation to do it, but I just know that just they're saying, well, look, let's just be careful if we're going to meet up in a group, and you can just buy them. They're quite inexpensive. So I think hopefully with this Delta and with the cases, it's something that It's something that the government are finally do. I think the government in Ireland are for it. It's the health Neffet and the chief medical officer are against it, and there's this kind of tug of war between the government and the health officials. So I don't know who's going to prevail.
Oh, it'll be interesting to see how that progresses. Tell us about the restaurants and the style of food that you do, JP.
So Anir, I suppose, is a fine dining Michelin star restaurant that does, I suppose, what you'd call contemporary Irish food. So, it's very influenced by the Nordic food movement. In, I suppose, when we opened in 2011, we use a lot of different wild herbs and seaweeds, and there's quite a lot of indigenous ingredients. Tartare is somewhere in between Anir and Cava. It's a cafe during the day and a wine bar at night, and does little small plates of Irish food, like oysters and tartare and different offerings. And then Cava, which was our first restaurant and it's still our busiest restaurant, is a tapas bar which very much looks to Spain, has an all Spanish wine list, all Irish produce, but again the lens is different. And I suppose they're three different, very different offerings at different levels, but I suppose it works for us because I suppose it's difficult to operate a fine dining restaurant in and of itself. So yeah, we felt it necessary over the years to try and supplement that with different styles of eating. And also I really love many different styles and ways of doing food. So I'd never, I suppose, limit myself to just one style.
Mm. So at Anir, and apologies for mispronouncing it at the start of the podcast, what's a sort of key dish, like sort of what speaks to modern Irish cuisine?
I suppose some of the dishes we've had on a long time are like maybe a charred oyster with some oyster mayonnaise, some pickled seaweed, some kind of beach herbs that we'd forage, a little bit of milled seaweed, like very finely milled. I mean, everything is very delicate, but all of the produce is Irish. We have like a lamb dish, and we might have a little pork belly dish, and like I suppose the seasoning is key, and like because we don't use say citrus fruits or spice or pepper, all of our seasoning comes from the wild. So whether that's through a flower, through a berry, through something that we've preserved or fermented. But like ironically, when I cooked in Australia, in Adelaide and Tasting Australia, like I actually requested Australian indigenous ingredients, and they're not a million miles. I suppose when you look at wild ingredients, they're similar the world over. Of course, there's different flavor profiles, but we ended up doing a very similar oyster dish to the one in Anir, and I remember taking a picture of it going, well, this could be contemporary Australian cuisine, but it's because it had so many different indigenous ingredients. And so I think it's just, for me, it's fun because when you travel and look at what grows locally and what has been there, I suppose, thousands of years, it creates interesting combinations that you possibly would not have done if you were just, I suppose, following some different trajectory.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, especially with the seasoning, I love the idea that you're not that you're keeping that very true to the region as well. And it sounds like seaweeds are quite a big focus as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose seaweeds have always been important because not only because we're by the coast and there are so many of them in Ireland, but they've also been overlooked for a long time in Ireland because of the way that the land, there is security of the land, and pretty much from when the potato came into Ireland in like the late 1600s, early 1700s, I mean, there was a kind of turning away from the wild because there was a stability, ironically, in the potato for a while, and then there wasn't. So it's, I suppose, it's important information to to keep or to try and relearn, because it's easily forgotten. And then you, if you have a generation or two that does not engage with the wild, then you'd be amazed how much you lose. And we're 10 years open in an ear, and we're always learning. There's always a new ingredient or a new plant that we come across, or a forager gives us, and we kind of like play around with it and say, oh, this is interesting. How can we? Even last night, we got a massive, gigantic pine cone, and we haven't used before, and we were like, what do we do with this? And we were like, oh, we could pickle it, and we could maybe try and like smoke it, and so we're gonna play around with it and see if we can get it to the point of being delicious and edible. And often it's not always possible.
You mentioned that an ear is very dependent on tourists. I mean, with doing that sort of investigation of the cuisine of the region, do you find that that's something that the locals are interested in, or are they a little bit hard to bring around?
It's a pre-pandemic, I mean, an ear could be 80% tourists. And then you would have people from Dublin, around the country, and then people from Galway. Ironically, then Cava is people, I suppose local people are very interested in. And I think it's that, I mean, there might be a similar phenomenon in Australia, with the fact that I think because we are from a cold climate, Irish people want food that represents warmness. And that's why I think we are always looking towards the Mediterranean for that discomfort. And I think that's why Cava was so successful. I think when Irish people look at an ear, sometimes they might find it quite austere, because we are restricting ourselves and our palate to a specific locality or just to a specific country. So, I mean, that appeals to tourists because they want to, I suppose, experience a region. But ironically, post-pandemic, but since we've reopened and there is a lot more staycations, then we've had a lot more Irish people who have actually come to the restaurant for the first time. And even though we're open 10 years, I'm still amazed. Even last night, people are like, oh no, it's our first time in. So I hope that with the pandemic, or one of the positives is that people might re-experience their own place and actually enjoy the food offering from that place.
Yeah, well, I suppose if there's one thing we've all got pretty used to, it's, you know, being where we are. So I think if we can go a bit deeper into home base and, yeah, appreciate it, look at it anew, find different angles, then I think that is a positive that we can take out of this whole period.
It was interesting when I was in Australia and we were cooking on Kangaroo Island, and some of the guests, because of course I'm sure you have the same, this weird mix of I wouldn't say it's not Englishness. It's like, well, Ireland and England are different and Australia is different again, but there's always some weird thing that joins us all together, even though Australia is so multicultural, that some of the people that were there, when I said I was using native Australian greens, they were like, what are they? Like, it was just, they were new to me, but they were just completely off the radar, I suppose, for people who feel that, well, Australia is 200 years old, or it's like from when people settled there, and not, I suppose, this kind of long space of like 40,000 years when people have been there. And it's similar in Ireland. Like, people have been in Ireland 10,000 years, but really when we think about Ireland and Irish food, really people are only thinking in a couple of hundred years. And they go, oh, well, what do you mean that native Irish ingredients? And you say, well, this is, people have eaten this for 9,000 years. And they go, oh, I didn't know that. Do you know? And it's even longer in Australia. And so there's, and it's all pre-written records. So it's really interesting, I think, to investigate them. And I suppose to try and work out how people ate them, and I suppose what do they contribute to the food culture of the area.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, the project of European colonization of Australia was definitely not to appreciate what was here in a culinary sense. It was about imposing, yeah, not only, I mean, crops and animals and certainly culture and, yeah, a whole new concept of ownership. So, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's a longer timeline with that process of colonization in Ireland. Yeah.
Yeah, it's more kind of geological. And like the colonization of Ireland, I suppose, was longer, I suppose, than Australia in the sense that it was 800 years. And so, like, Ireland was used for, like, I suppose, for breeding cattle, you know. And we still, even though we're independent, we 96% or 94% of the cattle we produce are exported. So we are to a certain degree, like, of course, we are independent, like, politically, but sometimes in terms of food, like, we just, I suppose, kept going with the same pattern of, I suppose, dairy farming and beef production. And I think that's why it's important to make these little forays into the wild, and just to see. It's never going to change things dramatically. You can't, like, just go into the wild and live off the wild. I mean, that's not what I'm saying. It's more, I always say, it's more as a seasoning, as a way to, because we all have lamb and we all have beef and we all have vegetables, but it's the way that you season them, I think, that often brings out the culture. And I think that's probably most apparent in a lot of Asian cooking. Like, it's still the same vegetables, but when you, regions are identified by the different spices or the different flavors or condiments that they use. And so I would hope over time that this way of seasoning would become more registered in Irish people's consciousness.
Mm, I mean, it's definitely one of the points of pride of a culture. I mean, you think about Spain or Italy, and, you know, how proud every village is or every province is of their own flavors and their own dishes. It would be, I mean, we love that diversity and those points of difference when we travel. And I think if the people that live in a place such as Ireland or such as Australia can also find pride in the ingredients that were growing there, you know, forever, then I think that's only a positive. It's just a richer food culture all around.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not about replacing, it's more about kind of just changing subtly and then transforming. You know, food always migrates, and you can't stop the migration of food the way when people migrate and foods change. And I think that's why, like, we have to allow food to migrate and allow people to experiment. And I think there's often, like, accusations of appropriation and like neo-colonization and that, but I think food has to be allowed to, I suppose, be an organic thing. And if you want to fuse two different things together, and it is in the spirit of feeding people, I think that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, well, I think it's the spirit of feeding people, but also the spirit of understanding and sort of trying to deepen your knowledge and trying to bring, I guess, a heritage or culture to the fore. Like, if it's done with respect and interest, then I feel like there's so many ways to, yeah, create and meld and, fuse, whatever, however you want to think about it. But I think there's definitely great ways of doing it that just create richness and new stories and connection, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, and I think that's for me the importance. I think always when you go to eat in another country and you go to eat in another person's house, I think that creates that dynamic and that sense of community. And then if, I suppose, we've collaborated over the years with so many different chefs from different places, and it's interesting stuff. That sometimes stuff doesn't work, but sometimes you come across new ideas. And I think that process of creativity is important for us, and it's also important to acknowledge where that creativity has come from. I think sometimes in the food world, people are under the impression that they just invent dishes and these new dishes come out, but there's always like places where these come from. And I think it's important to, almost like when you're writing a academic paper, like to cite. I think Will Goldfarb has often done this and citing, well, this technique comes from here and this technique comes from there and this is my new idea, or this is this food comes from here. And I think that's the respectful element about saying, well, this is where this stuff comes from, and that acknowledgement is part and parcel of the end dish.
Yeah, well, I think perhaps sometimes people have this idea that it's only creative and brilliant if it's come just out of a vacuum and you've created it from scratch. Whereas, of course, that's really never going to be the case. But actually, I think the brilliance is in taking things and putting, I don't know, finding a new way to talk about them or to express them in a culinary sense. And definitely, I guess, respectfully being part of a great narrative of a dish or an ingredient. And, you know, I suppose a dish can ask a question, well, what if it was like this? Or, you know, could this be how it is? Just in this moment, perhaps, or just in this place. I think, if you see yourself as part of a lineage and a narrative, then I think that's the best thing about food, I reckon.
Yes. No, I absolutely. I think that's what makes it exciting, and that's what I suppose that also makes you feel, as you said, that you're communicating with food through different generations, you know, or even in between generations, whether it's 5 or 10 years, or you see, I mean, we are open in near 10 years, and like other restaurants have opened since us and have developed along similar lines, and I think that's a really good thing to see us in terms of this trajectory, as opposed to see us in terms of being oppositional. Well, they opened and they're copying us, or they're taking away from this. I just see it as a kind of spectrum of like an investigation into Irish food or Irish food culture, and the more restaurants that do it, the stronger the movement will be.
Mm. I'd love to talk about Food on the Edge. The whole idea of a live food event is very exciting to me from locked down Melbourne. I think the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival was cancelled last year, snuck in March, and then the winter program's just been cancelled or perhaps postponed. But, you know, it's just very hard to get live events happening these days. I know yours has a virtual element as well, but tell me about it.
Yeah, it started 5 or 6 years ago as a way to showcase Ireland and its food culture to international chefs, and also then for those international chefs to teach us something and to bring what they are doing. And it has changed over the years in terms of its philosophy and its outlook, in terms of possibly when we opened first, or sorry, opened when we began first, we had a lot of, say, fine dining chefs and represented in the mix, a lot of Michelin stars, a lot of the world's best restaurants. And we've kind of ended up somewhere in the middle where, of course, those players are important for the development of food. But we've also kind of taken a wider kind of social gastronomic lens to the whole process and looked at how food is evolving in different places, like hospitals or institutions or prisons or in small micro communities. And so we try and mix it up between figures that are very well known in the food world around the world, and figures that people may not have heard of that we receive through recommendations, saying this person is doing something really interesting in this part of the world, and that's the kind of the blend. And we missed last year because of COVID. We released a book which is a free ebook called Cooking After COVID. It's still, I think you can still download it from our website. And we asked people from all over the world just to send an email similar to like a letter about how they're dealing with COVID or how they're responding to it. And I think there's about 200 emails in the book that we received from various different people. And this year we're fingers crossed, we're going for a blended event. The virtual aspect, the tickets are on sale, and people can do that. The in-house element is a little more difficult. At the moment, you can't do anything indoors for that amount of people, for 200 or 300. So we have a tent that is going to be outside, and we can have 200 at the moment. I'm hoping by the middle of October, we'll be allowed to have 300. And we have 50% of the participants are 50% of the speakers are coming, and the other 50% are just doing speaking virtually. And we decided that anyone outside Europe this year would just speak virtually, just because we just don't know the situation outside Europe. Like in Europe now, we have a COVID cert where you can fly as long as you're vaccinated, so there's no issue there. Whereas even, say, you mentioned Mark at the top of the program, I mean, Sydney and Melbourne locked down again. I mean, if we pay for flights, then people can't come, and it's hard to recoup some of those losses. So we just made that decision, and hopefully, fingers crossed, it will go ahead, it will happen, and we're entering new territory again in terms of this streaming it, and I hope it will bring it to more people around the world.
Yeah, well, that's the advantage, isn't it, of doing things virtually, is that people are able to access it who wouldn't be able to get there in person necessarily. So what do you reckon the big sort of strands of conversation will be?
Well, our theme this year is social gastronomy, that's which I mentioned. And so I think that food as a vehicle for whether it's empowerment, whether it's development of culture, whether it's the development of community, I think that will be one strand. And I think the other strand will most definitely be like how COVID has changed the way people eat. I suppose the way that we cook, or the people that we cook for, and I think that would be certainly a massive talking point. Like, we'll have a little artisan market, and even the conversations that happen with the people off stage. I think a lot of that will be you can't escape it. I suppose it's just there so much, and when you meet people, it's even with ourselves talking now, and we do a podcast with Food on the Edge as well, and you always try and not have the first question be about COVID, but the minute you go, how are you, and they go, oh, I'm fine, and what's it like there, and it's just we always say we're not going to talk about COVID first, and then it just happens, because you just say, oh, how are you, and they go, oh, we're locked down again, or we didn't open, or we opened but it's not great. And so it's I'd say, even though we're trying for the theme to be on social gastronomy, I think the theme will be on COVID, but who knows.
Well, I mean, they're interwoven, aren't they? I mean, it is, yeah, at the
I think definitely,
yeah, it's COVID is pretty dominant, and I suppose it threads in and out. In Australia, we've had long periods where we haven't had to worry about it too much. But I think, yeah, it's been a bit of a false dawn.
Yeah, and the weirdest thing is that we were looking at Australia and New Zealand as kind of like champions over here, going, oh my God, they have it right, and it's all grand, and this is what we need to do. And we tried the whole hotel quarantining, and it, because we share a border with England, with Northern Ireland, it didn't work. And yeah, it's just, there is so many, I think, false dawns over the last 2 years, and even still now we're open, but the cases are 2,000, and I'm still worried that, oh my God, in September, are we going to be closed again? It's like, are we going to be closed for, like, I think last year we were closed for 8 to 10 weeks, and then we were open to Christmas for 3 weeks, and then we were closed again for 6 months. So we're certainly not out of it yet. And it remains to be seen. My friend is working in the vaccination center, and they're doing thousands a day, but she said they're running out of people to do. Like, nearly everyone who wants to get vaccinated is done, like, in from say the 25 up to 65 to 70. So, like, if we're running out of people to vaccinate and the cases are still high, I don't know where else we can go. You know, it's do we just, I suppose, learn to live with it, or what do we do?
Well, I certainly do not have the answer, but they're questions that we can't help but keep asking. JP, it's been such a pleasure to have a chat to you today. I really look forward to the time where I can come back to Ireland and, yeah, enjoy exploring contemporary Irish cuisine in your safe hands. Thank you so much for chatting today.
Thank you so much.
This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you.